of bug kill. And so we desperately need to get in and remove the dead and dying material.
Goldmark says Washington will likely see more fires until forest health is improved. For NPR News, I'm Leslie McClurg in Seattle.
CSX train cars are being lifted from vehicles they crushed in a parking lot in Ellicott City, Maryland, overnight. The train was hauling coal when it derailed off a bridge, killing at least two people on the tracks. Diana Nyad's quest to become the first person to swim the Florida Straits without a shark cage has ended in disappointment just one day before her 63rd birthday. Nyad's support team pulled her from the water where she endured storms and jellyfish stings since she embarked on a journey from Cuba to Florida on Saturday. This was Nyad's third attempt since last year alone. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Poetry Foundation, celebrating 100 years of Poetry Magazine, online at poetryfoundation.org.
WILL programming is made possible by Sinfonia de Camera, whose 29th season features a 90th birthday celebration for composer George Walker. Beethoven's Symphony No. 9 hosts The Planets, Bach's St. Matthew Passion, conducted by Fred Stoltzfus, and Rush Hour in April. Ticket information is available at 333-6280.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. The following program comes from the Focus Archives, which means for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls.
In this part of Focus, we have what is really a fascinating story that comes out of the history of medicine. And it concerns a woman named Henrietta Lacks. She died in 1951 from a very aggressive case of cervical cancer. Before she died, a doctor took samples of her tumor and put them in a petri dish. And this was something that at the time was really quite common because scientists had been trying and failing for some time to keep human cells alive in culture. They'd been trying to do that for decades, but the cells, they would always die. They might live for a little while, but generally they would always die. Henrietta's cells were different. They didn't die. And in fact, they became the first immortal cells ever grown in a lab, and they have become essential in helping science better understand and treat disease. They've also generated enormous profits, something that Henrietta's family didn't learn about until more than 20 years after her death. In this part of Focus, we'll be getting this story from Rebecca Skloot, and she's the author of a newly published book, her first book. The title is The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, and it is published by Crown Books. It has just recently come out. Rebecca Skloot is a science writer. Her work has appeared in a number of places, including the New York Times Magazine, Discover, Columbia Journalism Review, other publications. She's also taught in the creative writing programs at University of Memphis and University of Pittsburgh. She's also taught science journalism in NYU's Graduate Science, Health, and Environmental Reporting Program. Ms. Skloot, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having
good.
Me.
Well, thanks very much for being with us. It's a great story, a truly great story. You first heard about Henrietta Lacks, I think probably the way that a lot of people would have, those people who do know, or at least who know about her cells, and that was in a classroom.
Yes.
Tell that story.
Yeah, I was 16 years old, and I was in a basic biology class. And, you know, my professor said what most teachers say at some point, which is, you know, there are these cells that have been alive since 1951 and growing in labs all over the world, and they were one of the most important things that happened to medicine. And what's interesting is that my teacher knew her name, so he wrote Henrietta Lacks on the board in really big letters and then said, she was black. And he said, you know, today there are far more of her cells growing than there ever were of her. And that was it, and class was over. And I sort of went up to him after class, and I said, why do we know that, and what else do we know, and, you know, do you have any kids, and what do they think about these cells? And I was just sort of became fixated on them. And he just said, sorry, we don't know anything. And he said, you know, go, you know, do a little research and see if you can come up with anything and write up a little extra credit thing. I'll give you some points. And so I went home and looked in my parents' encyclopedia, didn't find anything. And then that just started this decades of me just sort of being obsessed with these cells and trying to figure out who the woman was behind them.
Yeah. What I think is interesting is that I'm sure that so many other people, people who are now doctors and nurses and scientific researchers, also heard, they may not have heard that name, but they knew about these cells and kind of had some sense of what the story was. And you wonder how many of those people asked themselves that same question that you did, that question, well, who was this person?
Yeah, it's interesting. Some people, I definitely hear from scientists who say, you know, or just people who've taken biology classes who say, I've always wondered about this woman. But by far, the majority of scientists actually have never asked the question, which is part of what is interesting about the story. I get emails from scientists every day who say, you know, I've been working with these cells in my lab my entire career. I did my dissertation on these cells, and I never stopped to wonder where they came from. I never asked, like, whether she had given permission, whether she cared. Most scientists, if they've heard a name at all, they've heard this name Helen Lane, which was a pseudonym that was out there for a while. You know, and across the board, scientists hear the story, and they're really sort of shocked and I think very grateful to the family, and they start looking at the cells very differently. But for the most part, cells are kind of just this inanimate object in the lab to a lot of researchers. There's the test tubes and the fruit flies and the white lab mice and the HeLa cells, and they're just omnipresent. So a lot of times people just don't even stop to think about where they came from.
Yeah, and just again, so people understand, because no doubt they will again hear you refer to HeLa cells, that what they did was they took just the first two letters of each of her names, Henrietta Lacks, and attach that to the sample. So that's why it is that they were known that, and to this day are known as that.
Yeah.
She, maybe tell some more of her story. She knew that she was not well, so she went to Johns Hopkins Hospital. And the reason apparently she went to Johns Hopkins was at the time where she was living, it was the closest major hospital that would take patients who were black. And I guess maybe if we hadn't mentioned, we should mention that she was African American.
Yeah, so this was, you know, 1951, the Jim Crow era, and hospitals were segregated, and a lot of them just didn't treat black patients at all. And so, yeah, Hopkins was the closest hospital to her that treated black patients, but also Hopkins was a charity hospital. So it was where patients went who were poor as well, and Henrietta had no money for going to the doctor, and so she ended up there for both reasons. It was the place to go because she was black, but also because she could get treated without having to pay for it.
Mm-hmm. And the key here is that, and we should make sure that I guess people know that this was, at the time, very common practice, that they took a tissue sample. They didn't ask, may we do this? They just did it, and that apparently was just common practice at the time.
Yeah, it was standard practice. So, you know, when Henrietta showed up at Hopkins, scientists had been trying to grow human cells in culture for decades, and it had never worked. And what was interesting about Hopkins was they were actually doing a study there about cervical cancer. The Pap smear had just been developed, and scientists didn't know exactly how to interpret what they were seeing with the Pap smear. So they would take cells from a woman's cervix and look at it under the microscope, and sometimes they would see, you know, a bacterial infection and think that it was cancer and give a woman, you know, radiation treatment and a hysterectomy when all she needed was antibiotics. Or the other way around, they would mistake cancer for infections and just give her antibiotics and send her home. So there was this one researcher at Hopkins that was trying to grow cervical cancer cells in order to essentially prove what they looked like so that they could better use the Pap smear. So they were taking samples from any woman who walked into Hopkins with cervical cancer, and that's why her cells were taken. But this was also part of a larger effort to just grow any cells in culture. So scientists who weren't involved in cancer research were hoping to grow them for lots of other reasons, virology research and long list of things.
And as I mentioned in the quick introduction, that this was something that is trying to get human cells to grow in culture was something that scientists had been trying to do for a long time and without success.
Yeah, and so George Guy in particular, he had been taking cells from himself, from his patients. He had deals worked out with hospitals basically throughout Baltimore and D.C. where he would get samples, and he put them all in culture, and they all just died. And, in some ways, we don't exactly know why Henrietta's didn't. So, you know, they put her cells in culture, and they just started doubling their numbers every 24 hours. So they grew with this intensity that no one had seen before in culture. And they just never died. So, yeah, they're alive today, growing in laboratories around the world. They were, you know, and they were one of the most important things that happened to medicine probably in the last 100 years. They were used to help develop the polio vaccine. They went up in the first space missions to see what would happen to human cells in zero gravity. Her cells were the first ones ever cloned. Her genes were some of the first ever mapped. You know, they were used to create some of our most important cancer medications, like vincristine and tamoxifen, which pretty much everybody knows someone who's taken those drugs. Mm-hmm. The list of science that was done using them just goes on and on. And pretty soon, you know, there was a need to mass produce them. There was so much demand for these cells. And part of what was special about her cells is that they didn't just grow, but you could really mass produce them. So a factory was actually started up at the Tuskegee Institute where they started growing her cells to the tune of about 3 trillion cells a week and sending those out to scientists around the world. So the number of her cells that are, you know, sort of could be alive today is just inconceivable. One scientist estimated that if you could gather them all onto a scale and weigh them, they'd weigh more than 50 million metric tons, which is, you know, it's like more than 150 Empire State Buildings. You know, and each individual cell weighs almost nothing. So it's almost inconceivable the number of them that are out there.
Yeah. Our guest, let me just very quickly introduce again, is Rebecca Skloot. She is an award-winning science writer, and we are talking about the story that you can read in her book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. It's published by Crown Books. It has just recently come out. It's her first book. She's also written articles that have appeared in a lot of different places, New York Times Magazine, Columbia Journalism Review, and elsewhere. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free. 800-222-9455. Well, in the process of doing this, one of the things that you did was go and see how much you could find about Henrietta Lacks and who she was. So tell us about Henrietta.
Henrietta was a poor tobacco farmer from the southern, a small town in southern Virginia where her ancestors farmed the same land as slaves. So, you know, she still worked in the same tobacco fields that her ancestors had worked. And in the 40s, she moved up to Baltimore as part of this sort of migration. A lot of black farmers were moving up, were moving north because there were jobs in steel mills and shipyards. So her husband got a job up in Baltimore, and they moved up there. And that's where she lived for quite a while before being diagnosed. She had 5 kids. She was this sort of super mom. she had all 5 of her kids by the time she was 30, and she very much wanted to have more. And she was very devoted to them, and she was one of these people who just took care of everyone. She was the person who, when new people moved up from the South and came to Baltimore and needed a place to stay until they could get work, they would sleep on her floor. And so she would have, you know, sometimes a dozen people sleeping on her floor at any given time. She always had a pot of food on the stove that everyone knew if you didn't have any money, you could go to Henrietta's house and she'd feed you. And, you know, in a lot of ways, her family has always believed that these cells actually are very much like Henrietta. So, you know, her family's understanding of the science of the cells is very different from the scientists. You know, mm-hmm. they very much believe she was sort of brought back to life as an angel in these cells, you know, to cure diseases and sort of take care of people. And they sort of say, you know, that's exactly what she was like when she was alive too. It sort of makes perfect sense. And that they can be, you know, her cells can be very aggressive. There was actually a problem in the 60s that her cells can actually contaminate other cultures in a lab. So they can float on dust particles and travel on unwashed hands. And if they land in another culture dish, they'll just take over. And so there was this, they ended up causing sort of millions of dollars in damage by contaminating a lot of other cultures. And, you know, the family sort of always said, well, you know, that's because she got mad at scientists and she was, you know, you don't mess with Henrietta. She'll stick Gila on you and, you know, she'll kind of straighten you out. You know, and so a lot of, you know, the family's sort of understanding of the cells is very much linked with Henrietta. They feel that she's still sort of very much alive in there.
Yeah. She, as we mentioned earlier, she knew that something was wrong, and she knew that she needed medical attention. So she went to Johns Hopkins. She was diagnosed with this very aggressive. She was diagnosed with cervical cancer, this very aggressive cancer. She was diagnosed when she was 30 years old, and she died the next year. So she, very quickly after she was diagnosed, she passed away.
Yeah. Yeah, and she had her tumor when she first went in was about the size of a nickel. It was very, you know, not enormous. And within 7 months, every organ in her body was taken over by this cancer, and she died very quickly. So, you know, and there was something about her cancer. Her doctor, to this day, he's still alive. He's 99 years old. And to this day, he says, I remember that cancer. I never saw anything like it. It spread so fast, and the tumor itself looked very unusual to the eye. And, you know, so there was something about her tumor that was particularly powerful. That is probably part of why her cells were so sort of useful in the lab.
Yeah. She was treated with radiation the way that they did it then, which is not the way that we do it now, which sounds pretty pretty horrific when you read what it is exactly they did.
Yeah. So the standard treatment of the day was radium treatment. So these tubes filled with radium, which is radioactive material, were sort of literally sewed to the surface of the cervix to essentially burn off the cancer. And then after that, she also received radiation treatment, you know, similar to what we do now, but the levels of radiation were much higher then. So, you know, they burned the skin often. And this was the absolute cutting edge for the time. And, you know, we do actually still have that kind of internal radiation. You know, when you talk about treating prostate cancer by putting those seeds in the prostate, that's the same. It's the same concept. It's just that the levels of radiation were so much higher then that it was a much, you know, sort of harder treatment to deal with.
Yeah. We talked a little bit about the fact that one of the reasons that she went to Johns Hopkins, maybe the reason she went to Johns Hopkins, was that they would accept black patients. Mm-hmm. So then that invites a question, though, about the quality of her care. And, you know, would her care have been different, or might the outcome have been different if she was white?
Right. Yeah, it does. And it's sort of impossible to answer that question entirely. You know, I've read her medical records and have talked to the doctors and talked to lots of other experts in the area. And, you know, it's clear that she did get the standard treatment. She got the same, you know, medications that a white woman would have gotten. But one of the things we know now about the impact that segregation had on healthcare delivery is that black patients were often treated later in the disease process than white patients. They were often not given the same pain medications. They were hospitalized later. And she definitely was sent home many times before she was put in the hospital. It got to a point where she actually went to the hospital and said, "You have to check me in. I'm not going home. I'm too sick." There probably are moments where her care was a bit different because of the racial circumstances, and the end result wouldn't have changed, and her cancer was so aggressive, there was nothing that they could do. But, you know, I think there's probably questions about whether her pain could have been managed differently or whether she would have been in the hospital or, you know, treated more quickly or anything if she'd been white.
Yeah. Again, we talked earlier about the fact that for some time now, for a couple of decades, up to this point, scientists had been trying to get human cells to grow in culture without success. And so it was just routine for doctors to take tissue samples and not to ask, but just to take them, to put them in culture and to see what would happen. And we're constantly being met with the disappointment. What was the reaction now of the folks who did this when they looked at this and they saw what Henrietta's cells were doing?
Initially, they really didn't have much of a reaction at all, in part because I think they didn't exactly believe that they were going to keep growing. So at first, George Guy sort of said, we'll just see what happens. They're probably going to die. So there was a pretty long period where he just didn't tell anybody, and he just sort of sat on them, essentially waiting to see what would happen. But then there was a moment where he sort of realized these things aren't dying, and in fact, they're growing so fast, I can barely keep up with them. And at that point, he started telling his colleagues and his friends, I think, I've got this, you know, first immortal human cell line. And, you know, their response was, can we have some? George Guy started sending Henrietta's cells to anybody who wanted to use them in research. And at the time, you know, you couldn't just ship cells by mail. So he would take test tubes of her cells to the airport and go and find, you know, a flight attendant or a pilot who was going to say, Minneapolis or Chicago and say, would you put these in your pocket and take them where you're going? Because, you know, they needed to stay warm, essentially, for the trip, and they would do it. And so then a scientist would meet the pilot on the other end and grab the cells and run back to the lab and grow them and then give them to his friends, and then they'd give them to their friends and their friends. And initially that was how the cells spread, and there was this enormous excitement. People had been trying to do this, to grow cells like these, since the late 1800s. They knew that there were so many things they could learn about cells, about cancer. You know, we didn't even know what DNA was at that point. So cells were still a bit of a mystery, and the idea of being able to study, you know, one line of cells that would just keep growing and growing, and you could study them for many generations of cells, was just so exciting for scientists. Yeah.
And that there certainly it would enable you to do various kinds of mm-hmm. experiments and studies that you couldn't otherwise do. You certainly couldn't do them on living people.
Right, exactly. Right. And this was an important, very important point. You know, you could not shoot a human being up into space really initially without seeing what might happen to that person up there. You couldn't expose a person to large amounts of radiation on a regular basis to see what the atom bomb might do. They were able to do these things with cells.
They were apparently, among all these other things that you mentioned, they were also the first cells to be frozen.
Yeah, they were, so much of the basic foundation of what we almost take for granted today in science labs was done using her cells. The ability to freeze and thaw cells without damaging was sort of perfected using her cells. What do they eat in culture? You have to feed cells. So finding the perfect culture medium to grow them in so that they, kept them fed and, alive. They just learned all of these things right down to which slide covers are the most appropriate, which test tubes, some of them they found out were toxic to cells, and they didn't know that. So every little detail that we now know about cell culture and sort of how best to grow cells, they figured out using her cells.
And you had this opportunity to talk with the physician that had treated her, and certainly he said that he still remembered the cancer. He certainly said in all of the time he'd been a doctor, he'd never seen anything like it. No one apparently seems to know why it is that these cells were so that they would grow this way.
There's some things that they definitely know about why her cells grow. So she had HPV, which is the virus that causes cervical cancer, and it interacts with DNA in certain ways and can cause cells to grow out of control. That's how it causes the cancer. So they know that that's part of it. She had multiple strains of it, so that may have had something to do with it. She also had syphilis, which can weaken your immune system and cause cells to grow, cancer to grow even more powerfully. But a lot of people did in the 50s, and nobody else's cells did this. We also know that her cells have this particular enzyme that rebuilds the ends of their chromosomes, so they never actually get old. It just sort of, they stay young and they don't die in part because of that. But why her cells did that when no other cells did is still a little bit of a mystery. It's funny, I talk with groups of scientists all the time, and there's often this moment when I say that and scientists look at each other and go, we don't know that? Why don't we know that? We should know that. And so there are actually scientists now who, I've talked to who are sort of looking into that, see if they can find some very specific thing that makes HeLa, different.
Yeah. And the cells are referred to as immortal because they are, and that's where the title of the book comes from. Have other immortal cells been found since?
Yeah, there are other immortal cell lines for sure, and some of them, were able to grow in a similar way to, in terms of the method that was used, a similar way to HeLa cells. HeLa cells remain very sort of unique in the way that they grow and that sort of thing. You can now actually immortalize a normal cell. So you can immortalize any cell by changing it with a virus and doing various things. So we now have tons of immortal cells, but this sort of naturally occurring, like hers, doesn't really exist in the same way.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Rebecca Skloot, is an award-winning science writer. Her articles have appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Columbia Journalism Review, the Oprah Magazine, elsewhere. She's the author of a newly published book. The title is The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, and Crown is the publisher on the book. We do have a caller, and let's talk with them. They're in Champaign, line one.
Hi,
hello.
Good
yes.
morning.
Yes.
I have a question about about her family and about whether if there are still family members out there, whether their cells have been collected and whether they cross-reference with them to see what it is, what particular essence of that cell makes her particular cells so aggressive. And, you know, as a way of, you know, checking and seeing if there's something peculiar about these cells that might tell us more.
Yeah.
Well, have they checked with her family?
This is another big part.
I was just
going to
say, I'm glad you asked that.
Half of the story here that the book tells. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that because, right, I mean, a good, you know, the book traces a lot of different stories, the story of the cells, the story of Henrietta, the stories of the evolution of bioethics, but it's very much also the story of her family. So her family didn't know that these cells were taken until the early 70s when, for basically exactly what you're talking about, in order to learn more about the cells, some scientists decided to track down her kids to get some DNA samples so that they could use them to study HeLa cells. And, you know, Henrietta's husband had a third-grade education. He didn't know what a cell was. And he got this phone call one day, and the way he understood it was, we've got your wife. She's alive in a laboratory. We've been doing research on her for the last 25 years.
Oh, my goodness.
And now we have to test your kids to see if they have cancer, which wasn't what the doctor said at all. They weren't testing the family for anything. They were using their samples for research. But, you know, her husband's understanding was that they had Henrietta in a cell, like a prison cell.
Oh, my.
That was his only reference point. So, you know, her family sort of got sucked into this world of research that they didn't understand. They didn't realize they were being used in research. And for the family, it sort of, the timing made sense. Henrietta's daughter, Deborah, was 26 years old. She knew that her mother died around 30 and didn't know why. No one talked about Henrietta. And so she thought the doctors were coming to test her to see if she was going to die at the same time that her mother did. And so it was pretty traumatizing for the family. And the research that they did using the family samples didn't so much tell us, didn't really tell us anything about why Henrietta cells grow or why they don't. It was more about using them to settle this contamination controversy. So, you know, her cells had contaminated all these different cultures in labs, and a lot of scientists were denying that it had even happened. And so they used her family samples sort of like you would a crime scene sample.
Mm-hmm.
They took their DNA and compared it to the cells to prove, you know, which ones were HeLa and which ones weren't, and they were essentially all HeLa. And there was actually a point when various other scientists started hearing, hey, someone has access to the family, and they would request samples from, so scientists would go back and take more samples from the family and send them to other people. And but the research done on that never looked at, you know, why the cells were growing the way they did. They just sort of looked at other things, and they never looked at anything within the family. The family doesn't have, you know, cancer or any cells, you know, that sort of resemble these. Since her cancer was caused by HPV, you know, which is sexually transmitted, it wasn't something she passed to the kids.
But does the family understand now what's been happening and how their cells are being used and how do they feel about it?
Yeah.
I feel.
That's, you know, so when I came along in the 90s hoping to write this book, I didn't know anything about what had happened to the family. And it's been this long saga for them. So, you know, they were used in the research. At some point, Henrietta's medical records were released to the press and published. Some of her children's medical information was published.
Oh, my God.
There was just so many different points where they were, you know, there were these sort of privacy violations. And, you know, when I came along, still no one had explained to them what a cell was. And this was another 25 years after they'd learned about the cells. So they, you know, part of the book, one of the things, the ways that it took me about a year and a half to convince the family to talk to me at all. And part of that was just the mistrust between, you know, I was yet another person coming along wanting something from them, particularly a white person. And one of the ways that I sort of eventually won their trust was by sharing information with them and saying, look, you can come with me. We'll go into the labs. We'll go see your mother's cells for the first time. We'll, you know, sort of try and help them learn what actually happened. And so now they do have an understanding. I mean, Deborah in particular, she would come travel with me, and she got to see her mother's cells. Finally, it was not until she was in her mid-50s. But she did finally get to sort of see her mother's cells and have a scientist explain what they are and what it means that they're alive. And you know, for Deborah, as I think I mentioned earlier, she very much believed her mother's soul was alive in these cells. So the idea that scientists were, you know, shooting them up to the moon and injecting them with chemicals was very disturbing to her. She was very worried about whether her mother could rest in peace when this was happening and whether it caused her mother pain. And
I would think the cells would also be interesting in terms of our studying DNA and where people come from, what their history is, how far back they could trace them back to her roots in Africa.
Yeah, and, you know...
there must be...
Well, this is
one of the things that are interesting about these.
Yeah, and there are, and this is one of the sort of complicated issues that comes up with cells now. So, you know, it's true that basically anybody could look at these cells and learn about Henrietta's past. They can learn about her children because their DNA is in there too. And, you know, that's there are big privacy issues there. You know, people could find out things looking at those cells that would apply to her kids medically, and they have no ability to say, don't do that. And that's our private information.
Have they sought a legal counsel at all about what their rights are? Or?
Yeah, they, you know, one of the tough things about the story is there were no laws broken in any of this. There were no laws that said you can't take tissues from people without their knowledge. There sort of still aren't. I mean, you can't go to a person and take samples from them for research now without telling them. You know, if it's specifically for research. But, you know, when we go, most Americans have their tissues on file somewhere, and when you go to the doctor, you get a biopsy taken. You know, we sign forms that say, you know, you can dispose of my tissues any way you see fit. Yeah. Sometimes it says you can use them for education and research. But, you know, that's what all this means, is it goes and is used for research. And, you know, it's an important thing. We want that. That's where our most important, you know, drugs and vaccines come from. And,
well,
know,
maybe
but people want to know.
Maybe there's another book or another whole generation of knowledge coming out of this. At the end, we may find out even more stuff that is valuable, and you'll have to write another book.
You're not the only one. Yeah, Deborah Lex has often said that she thinks I'm going to be writing a trilogy. I'll be writing about this story for the rest of my life, which I feel like I'm hoping that it's all in this book.
Well, again, I want to thank the caller, invite others. We're moving into about our last 20 minutes. Rebecca Skloot is our guest. She's a science writer, and she's authored this book. It's her first book. It's The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, and it's published by Crown Books. Other questions, welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. You talked about how, for you as a journalist, one of the challenges was establishing some kind of relationship of trust with Henrietta's children, so you could report the story. Her children certainly had a very hard life after their mom died, and in fact, some of them were so young that they really didn't remember her at all. So for them, one of the things that turned out here was that you were a path for them to come to know their mother in a way that they never did.
This was particularly important for Deborah. I mean, this is why she ended up sort of eventually agreeing to talk to me. Was, you know, she was two when her mother died, and she didn't know anything about her. And when her Henrietta's children were very badly abused after her death. They had very hard lives, and Deborah sort of held out this image of her mother and this idea of her mother as a sort of sanctuary. When, you know, when bad things were happening in her life, she would think, you know, if my mother was here, she wouldn't let this happen. And so she just really longed to know about her mother. And so, you know, when I came along and started trying to talk to her and she wouldn't talk to me, it was very clear to me that she wanted to know essentially the same thing I did, which was who was her mother, what happened with the cells. And so I would, you know, go and do reporting trips where I would go and find Henrietta's siblings and her cousins that she grew up with, and I would get them to tell me stories of Henrietta as a child, and I would start calling Deborah's voice answering machine. She would never answer the phone. She had caller ID. And so I would leave these stories on her answering machine saying, oh, I just, you know, talked to your cousin Cliff. Down, you know, he told me this great story about your mom when she was a kid. And I would tell her the stories on her answering machine. And later she fessed up that she was sort of sitting over the machine really wanting to pick up and wanting to ask me questions about the stories but being sort of afraid to. And it became this sort of quest where we were both traveling around, you know, learning about her mother. And it's interesting now that the book is done, you know, there are many more generations of Laxes who didn't know the story. So, you know, Henry and his kids are in their 60s and 70s now, and they have kids and grandkids and great-grandkids, and they've all read the book, and it's been this pretty incredible thing for them to finally understand what happened to their parents, what happened to Henrietta, because all of these were stories that no one talked about in the family. They were traumatizing, so they didn't talk about them for that reason, but also some of it was that they just didn't really know a lot of the stories themselves.
Mm-hmm. We talked about the fact that the person to grow the cells,
yeah.
George
Guy,
once he saw what he had, got very excited about the potential for research. And when other researchers that he knew found out about it, as you said, they said, well, can we have some? And he said, sure. So he was just giving them away, and then they were being passed around. But eventually there was so much demand for these cells that an industry to mass produce them sprung up. So that gets to this question of, over time, is it possible to say how much income has been generated as a result?
I tried very hard to find a number that I could use for that, but it really is impossible to figure out because, yeah, in the 50s, as a way to, you know, cell culture, particularly in the 50s, was so labor-intensive. Scientists were spending all of their time just trying to grow the cells, and they didn't have any time left to do research on them. It was sort of like if you had to build a microscope every time you wanted to look through it. It was just, they couldn't keep up with it. And so some scientists actually convinced a company to start up just to sell them the cells. They said, we'll teach you how to grow the cells. We'll give you everything you need. Just please sell them to us. And so this first company started up just basically to sell HeLa cells. And, you know, since then, we have this enormous industry, this multi-billion-dollar industry that's grown involving selling biological samples, you know, cells, tissues, patenting genes, all of that. You know, you can trace a lot of our biggest biotech companies back to that one company that started with HeLa cells. So there's this enormous industry there, but it's very hard to actually put a dollar figure on it. Anyone can go online and order a vial of her cells for $200 a vial, or sometimes $250. And then there's this range of products that are made using her cells, and they go all the way up to about $10,000 a vial for, you know, some extracts of certain things from the cells. And, you know, there's this a lot of questions about that. Some of it is just selling the raw materials. Here's HeLa cells for some money. But a lot of it is, you know, products that a lot of other things went into. You know, a lot of work by scientists, a lot of other materials, and sort of sorting out what of that $10,000 vial is HeLa and what is all these other things is something that no one's ever really tried to do. Mm. I think we're at this point where they're talking about that, and they're sort of saying, how do we determine the value of the actual raw materials? You couldn't have those products without the raw materials of the cells, but the cells themselves, just sort of put in a lab somewhere, would just die without all the intervention from scientists and the work that comes after that.
Yeah. Just I asked that question going for also the next point that's mm-hmm. a really sad irony of the yeah. story is that this family, these are not wealthy people, and you know they're poor folks, and not only are they poor, but here their mom and you know in some cases grandma, who was the source of these cells that have generated so much benefit to science, so many people's lives have benefited. It did generate profits. These are poor folks. They don't even have health care themselves.
Yeah, that really gets at the core of what I think most people find most upsetting about the story is here's this family who, you know, their mother is somehow involved in some of our most important medical advances, and her family doesn't have access to those advances at all. And one of her sons recently had a quadruple bypass, and you know, one of the last things he remembers when he went under anesthesia was his doctor sort of gushing and saying, your mother's cells were so important for science, and they probably helped us figure out how to do a lot of this stuff. You know, I mean, doctors treat them like rock stars when they go into the hospital. Because they're like, oh, my God, you're HeLa's kids. And then her son woke up $150,000 in debt because he couldn't afford he didn't have insurance to cover the procedure. So, you know, that irony is a very sort of painful one. And one that, you know, I think is part of the larger discussion about sort of healthcare. You know, this question of who gets access to the medical advances made using cells taken from everyday people for free often without them even realizing it. You know, those same people then have to go and pay for the advances and often can't afford it. And so it's this, it really highlights a place in which our medical system is a little broken.
Yeah. And if you, as I expect you did, talk with scientists who whose work ultimately has benefited from this, they recognize, they will admit that they owe a great debt to Henrietta?
Yeah, for the most part. The response to from scientists to this book has been pretty amazing. You know, they often, the first response they have is, you know, oh my God, I had no idea. You know, I've been working with HeLa cells my entire career, and I never stopped to think about where they came from. And yeah, they feel like they want to say thank you to the family. They want to say they're sorry. They want to explain what they did with the cells so that the family can understand what their particular research was for. And there is this, I think, desire to sort of do something in response to the family. There are definitely some scientists out there who think the whole thing is a little ridiculous, who sort of say, you know, this is just going to give people the false impression that they should have some control over their tissues. You know, this is, people owe this to society to contribute these materials and let them be used in research. And, you know, the interesting thing, there have been lawsuits over this, you know, someone whose cells were used in research finding out after the fact, and maybe they were, some people's cells were patented and worth a lot of money, though that's very rare. And, you know, across the board, the courts have ruled against people, the patients in these cases, saying that to give anyone property rights over their tissues would interfere with science. And there's sort of a debate going on about that now. But, you know, I've talked to everyone involved in any of those lawsuits and also the Lax family. And across the board, their response is essentially, you know, if they had just asked us, we would have said yes. Mm-hmm. If they had said, can we use your cells for this research? We might profit off of it. You won't. The majority of people would say yes. Where the anger comes from is when they find out after the fact and they feel like they've been deceived. And then that's when you get a lot of lawsuits. And, you know, there are certainly people out there who wouldn't want their tissues used in research. There are some religions where it violates their religion to do it. Or, you know, there's some people who don't like the idea of the commercialized aspect of it. And, yeah, you know, they say we should have the right to say no. So, yeah, there's all these big issues surrounding it. And they often come back to this one sentence that the family says over and over again, which is, you know, if our mother's cells were so important to medicine, why can't we go to the doctor?
Yeah. I guess I can understand the point that this kind of material is really important for the advancement of science and that everyone benefits. At the same time, there seems to be something fundamentally wrong with the idea that we don't own ourselves.
It does. It just sort of disturbs people. It's just this idea that, right, there's part of you that may be living on somewhere and you have no say in that or what happens to that. You know, and those, one of the big differences between the story of the HeLa cells and the story of, you know, everyone else's cells is that our names are removed from those tissues now, mm-hmm, and hers wasn't. You know, and so people often point to that. You know, these are anonymized. It's not like your cells are sitting somewhere. You know, my cells aren't there with, you know, Rebecca Skloot on them. But, you know, one of the things that a lot of scientists have pointed out is that technically it is possible to basically find someone using DNA in their tissues. And it's been done, and it's not easy, and it's not something people are doing sort of a lot, but it's possible. And when you look at the 50s, when Henrietta's cells were taken, they didn't even know that DNA was in there. They had no idea they'd someday be able to look at her cells and learn something about her kids and her grandkids. So the question of what these, you know, supposedly now anonymous tissues will be able to tell us in 10 years about the person they came from, nobody knows. But if we look at the history of science, it's pretty clear that they're going to tell us more than we think they do. So in some ways, it's a case of sort of, you know, science moving a bit more quickly than the regulations that sort of governed it, and now people are looking at it saying, okay, we should probably have a discussion about this.
One thing that I know that you've done is that you've set up a foundation, yeah, to in the hope that will benefit the family, the Lax family, and some of the money that you're earning from the book is going to go into that.
Yeah, this was something that was really, I struggled with when I first started talking to the family, and I started learning about their story and that they had, that I was one in a long line of people who'd come wanting something from them, and I was going to potentially benefit. I mean, I was a grad student at the time. I sort of couldn't even conceive that the book would ever actually get published, but, you know, I told them going in, if it ever happens, you know, I wanted to establish this foundation, and the way I've set it up is it's a foundation where, you know, the primary beneficiaries right now are the, you know, members of the Lacks family, descendants of Henry Lacks, and it's a, there's a scholarship fund that will be available to them to get it, money for education, which was really important. I think, you know, at some point Deborah also realized that in a lot of ways this story is about education, and her family didn't have access to education. You know, her kids were all deaf and hard of hearing, and they didn't, no one knew it until they were adults, so they never really learned to read and write much because they couldn't hear in school. And, you know, her, the parent, Henrietta and her husband didn't have an education, and Deborah came to realize that if she'd been able to go to school, probably a lot of this wouldn't have been as scary. She could have asked the questions she needed to ask of the scientists to get them to talk to her. You know, so it's sort of a story about education on both sides. It's also, you know, it's also the story of the importance of scientists being able to communicate to the public about science, particularly a public that's not knowledgeable about science and is maybe even a little scared of it. So I thought, you know, a scholarship fund made sense. And then there's also a fund for part of that will hopefully be able to help her kids with health insurance. Yeah, and I have very grandiose ideas about how, depending on how big it gets, I'd like to open it up to be, you know, a Henrietta Lacks scholarship for, you know, African Americans who want to go to school, study science. So I have sort of grand plans about it. But, yeah, there's a percentage of the proceeds from the book go in there. And then anyone can donate. There's a website, henriettalacks.org, and there's a donate button there and an address that people can send checks to. And it's interesting that, I mean, scientists and the general public are definitely donating. They're, I think a lot of scientists feel that they do personally owe her something, and so they've been donating in different ways, which is great.
There's so much more that we could talk about. We're coming down to the point. We have maybe about 3 minutes left. Okay. Something else, though, that I would really like to have you address, and that's some people see this story and perhaps have misunderstood this story and have placed it in this rather dark chapter of the history of medicine in the United States that has to do with race and racism in medicine. And, you know, right at the head of that chapter is Tuskegee, the Tuskegee syphilis studies. And that some people apparently have said, well, this is just another one of those examples. And, you know, if she'd been white, she would have gotten better treatment. Or I suppose there are some people who think that maybe she was deliberately infected with something and so forth. And so the story has apparently long been held up as a story like Tuskegee, which really it wasn't.
Right. It's much more complicated than that. It's a hard point to convey in some ways. It's, you know, and that's one of the things I really set out to do in my book, is sort of just tell both sides of the story and really show the ways in which race was involved, the ways in which it wasn't. You know, the issue of class, in a lot of ways, it's so much a story about class and access to, you know, people having money for these things. But, you know, it has been held up. George Guy has often been called, you know, this racist white scientist who knew this black woman's cells were valuable and stole them from her and got rich off of them. And none of that's true. He didn't even know she was black until well after the cells grew. You know, he was just getting this sort of stream of samples from other doctors all over the place that would send them to him. You know, so the cells weren't taken because she was black. They weren't. It wasn't that anyone knew they were valuable on the front end, you know, but you can't separate race from the story. She was absolutely at Hopkins because it was, you know, a segregated ward where she could get treatment. And, you know, but he definitely didn't give her any sort of cancer. There has also been a question about whether he treated her or whether he essentially let the cancer grow in order to grow the cells, which definitely didn't happen. You know, I try to tell both sides of the story to show the places where, you know, race does come into it and the places where it's really about just human, you know, the humans on both sides, the people behind the samples and also the people behind the scientists who, you know, sometimes made some mistakes.
Yeah. One other little detail that I really like, you explain in the book, and you've explained here that the first time that you heard about Henrietta Lacks, you were in community college and biology class, and the instructor was there, and he was talking, and he wrote the name down, Henrietta Lacks, wrote on the board, and you became really interested and wanted to know something about her and who she was, and he said, well, go out and you do some work on this, and maybe you'll get a little extra credit. So apparently, once you finished the book, you sent him a copy.
I did. I tracked him down. You know, I hadn't seen him, this is like since the late 80s, and I tracked him down, and I sent him a copy of the book before it came out, with a note that just said, you know, dear Mr. Duffler, here's my extra credit project. It took about, 25 years longer than, it's about 25 years late, but I have a really good excuse. It was really hard to find anything. And he was just shocked. I mean, he was a community college teacher. He's been retired for quite a long time. And this isn't, it's not the kind of story that often happens to a community college teacher. So he was just, he was thrilled. And he's in the story of me learning about the cells in the classroom with him in the classroom is in there. And so he opened up the book, and one of the first scenes you read is, Mr. Duffler in the classroom. So I think he was a little shocked.
Well, I'm sure that he was. That's the kind of thing that if you were a teacher, maybe you say to yourself, well, maybe it was all worth something after all.
Yeah, I hope so.
Hey, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me. And I'll also I'll be in several places in Indiana, too, which may be close to some of your listeners. They can find the details at RebeccaSkleet.com.
On the website. That's great. Well, again, thanks.
Thanks.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu. WILL is your source for comprehensive coverage of the Republican and Democratic National Conventions. Each night of both conventions, NPR will bring you live reports and analysis on AM 580, while the PBS NewsHour team will provide live coverage on WILL-TV. Our national convention coverage begins Monday, August 27th at 7 p.m. from the GOP National Convention in Tampa. WILL, your source for in-depth election news.
Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting community participation in the monthly Dance for People with Parkinson's class, meeting this month on Friday, August 24th at 10 a.m. in Krannert Center's Drama Rehearsal Room. For more information, call 217-333-6280 or visit KrannertCenter.com.
On tomorrow's Focus, a conversation with Dr. Robert Morgan, professor of English at Cornell University, author of Lions of the West, Heroes and Villains of the Westward Expansion. It's a rebroadcast from December of last year. Then in the 11 o'clock hour of the program, a repeat from May of 2010, conversation with writer Nathaniel Philbrick, author of The Last Stand, Custer, Sitting Bull, and the Battle of Little Bighorn. On Thursday's show, we'll rebroadcast a conversation from November of 2011 with a professor of law at George Washington University Law School, Daniel Solov, author of Nothing to Hide, The False Trade-Off Between Privacy and Security. Then in the 11 o'clock hour, conversation with Mark Moffat, a biologist and photographer and author of Adventures Among Ants, A Global Safari with a Cast of Trillions. Those are the conversations ahead on Focus in the next couple of days. Stick around, the afternoon magazine is just a couple of minutes away here on WILL AM 580. Among the stories we're following at this hour, the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign is one of the nation's top party schools, according to an annual survey. We'll tell you all about that. Also, Illinois Governor Pat Quinn signed a law that he says will improve access to health care for Illinois children. Urbana's city council has unanimously agreed to back changes to the city's zoning ordinance to allow applications for gun stores and indoor firing ranges.
And an Indiana legislative committee plans to discuss whether the joint campus run by Indiana and Purdue universities in Fort Wayne should become an independent school. Those stories ahead, also the latest international news from the BBC, news from NPR, and we'll tell you about a new exhibit that opened at the Burpee Museum of Natural History in Rockford earlier this month, featuring an eccentric musician's collection of, well, stuff over the course of a half century in rock and roll. That's all ahead in the next hour. Let's get you caught up now on what's happening in the commodity markets, starting with Kansas City wheat for September at 9.06 and 3 quarters, up 15 and 3 quarters. December wheat's at 9.31, up 15 and a half. Chicago wheat for September's at 8.96 and 3 quarters, up 17 and a quarter. December wheat at 9.18 and a quarter, up 15 and a half. September corn's trading at 8.26 and a half, up 11 and a quarter. December corn at 8.34 and a quarter, up 10 and a half. March 2013 corn at 8.33, up 9. May 2013 corn at 8.25 and 3 quarters, up 9 and a quarter. September beans are trading at 17.46 and a quarter, up 42 and a half. November beans at 17.26, up 42 and a half. January 2013 soybeans at 17.13 and a quarter, up 39 and a half. And March soybeans at 16.10 and a half, up